I'm Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capizani.
Welcome back to A Hostile Climate.
And in today's episode, we are continuing on. We had so much to say in our last conversation in our episode on scarcity.
Picking up where we left off.
So, Alex, we're back to continue this conversation, but with a new guest today.
Last week, we talked to John Berggren, who's a policy expert from Western Resource Advocates on the Colorado River and water policy in the West. And today, we're going to talk to a writer who covers water issues in the West, Heather Hansman. Heather has written pieces for Outside Magazine, The Guardian, New York Times, and her first book, Downriver, is all about water in the West and the future of water in the West. So Downriver, Into the Future of Water in the West, is Heather's story of floating the length of the Green River, one of the largest tributaries of the Colorado, and talking to different stakeholders and communities along the way about how they see their water future unfolding.
And a really kind of amazing opportunity here was because we kind of got a 30,000 elevation kind of overview and some degrees of detail on these challenges with John. But we have an opportunity today to, like you were saying, not only hear about stories from people that live along the river or whose livelihoods are heavily impacted by changes and access to water as we go forward, and to really start to see those contestations around water rights that we started to talk about and how that's playing out, not just between states, but also of communities within states. But also, Heather is a river rafting guide and herself talks about the experience and the importance of doing her work and her writing while on the river itself and being surrounded and in that particular environment.
So one of the reasons that I'm super excited to talk to Heather today is that while last week we talked about scarcity is this management problem, it's also a really personal problem, right? So scarcity, what we do when there isn't enough, is not just a policy level issue, but it affects how people live, move, and experience the world around us, right? Scarcity is this really personal, phenomenological way that we interact with our environment. And that's something that we should really think about as we try to unpack this and understand it.
Exactly. And as we, you know, continue to face new challenges where climate change is going to maybe exacerbate elements of scarcity with particular resources or even narratives of scarcity that climate change tends to introduce, thinking about it on this individual level, on how it's experienced, and then the kind of implications for that for people as they try to make plans, when they try to coordinate amongst other individuals, you know, within the context of their own families or their own communities, or trying to make decisions around their livelihood is all contextualized. I'm thinking back to the last episode when you talked about the fish in the fishbowl, where of course the people brushing our teeth draining the fishbowl, but we might also be in the fishbowl itself. So what is it to be in a place where it feels like that water level is shrinking? So maybe this episode is sort of the phenomenological experience of being the fish in that fishbowl to some extent, or at least to find out about different fish's experience in there.
So we're gonna jump in a fishbowl.
Together.
let's dive in. We're in the fishbowl and let's talk to Heather.
To maybe give a little bit of context about me to back it up a little bit, before I was a journalist and, you know, spent most of my days sitting in front of a computer staring at words, I was a raft guide. I started doing that when I was in college. It was sort of my main job for a, you know, big chunk of my 20s. It's what moved me. I live in Colorado now. Rivers were kind of like what moved me west in the first place. And so I'm somebody who came from a place of caring about rivers a lot. And then when I got into journalism and environmental reporting, I started to realize that even though I was somebody who had spent a lot of time on rivers and cared about them a lot, I didn't totally understand how water systems worked and how water was managed. And I think kind of living, especially in the western half of the US, you kind of get these, you hear a lot of news about drought and water and rivers. And it all felt really intangible to me. I didn't really understand how it worked and why it didn't work. And I figured that if I was somebody who was a reporter and who cared about rivers and who didn't understand it, that probably there were a lot of other people who didn't understand it too. So I decided that, and this is where I, you know, after I got into the reporting process, I kind of got myself checked on this a little bit, but I decided that I was going to write the book to understand water in the West.
Somebody had to do it.
Clearly nobody had done it yet. And I decided that the best way to do that was on the river. So I kind of schemed up this harebrained source to confluence trip of the Green River, which is the biggest tributary of the Colorado River. It starts in the Wind River Range, Wyoming, goes through Wyoming, a little bit of Colorado, Utah, Canyonlands. It kind of meets up with the main stem of the Colorado there in Canyonlands. And so I use that trip to look at how that river is used and allocated and kind of where the conflict points along the river were and where people were getting along and weren't getting along. And kind of use that trip as a framework to try and figure out what all this water policy meant and how it played out on the ground. Because that felt important to me to kind of connect the policy, kind of what people often call dry water or, you know, paper water, with the wet water, what was happening on the ground in the rivers. So yeah, that was a little bit more than 30,000 foot view, but basically Downriver is the book. The book is a story of a trip down a river that tried to understand the water system along that river and kind of big picture water in the West.
I would love just a little bit more detail to actually hear about the trip itself. Just if you could like locate, you know, listeners a little bit, like how long did that take? What were some of, I mean, the elements that you were facing? How were you conducting that trip? And then maybe that'll help to get into kind of the phenomenology of that experience.
I'm pretty curious
in that story also, like what are some of the things that most surprised you and what are the things that didn't in the place?
Yeah. And I think those things are like pretty connected in a lot of ways. So yeah, the Green River is 730 miles and it starts in kind of the high, really high, dry mountains of Wyoming. And it's actually, it sources what's called the Green River Lakes, which are these really beautiful sort of like crystal lakes surrounded by these huge peaks in Wyoming. And then it drops into pretty sparse kind of ranch land from there. You know, in a lot of these places, and we can dig into this more, but there was a report that came out in the past couple weeks about uses of the Colorado River. And the number one ag is more than half of the use of water. And of that, alfalfa for cows is the biggest chunk of that. So the kind of biggest single user of Colorado River water is hay for cows. And in those kind of like upper chunks of the river there in Wyoming, that's kind of the only use. And to get to your question, Alex, about sort of like assumptions and questions I had coming into this trip, coming from, you know, the recreational standpoint, coming from somebody who had these sort of maybe almost like city kid ideas about conservation, I could look at those numbers saying ag was using the most water, you know, and it's all going to cows, and kind of be like, I can tell you how to change things. Like, this is where we've got to cut it back. And then I ended up spending time with ranchers in that area who are, A, there's sort of longstanding historical reasons why that's the main use for water. There's, you know, families who've been on the same landscape for generations who are making this sort of like pretty scrappy, hard go of a living up there, because in a lot of places, grass is the only thing that will grow. Like, other crops don't do well. And who are also really good stewards of the landscape and who kind of like had this framework for how to take care of other species on the land, how to think about, you know, like what their water table is looking about, and like landscape connectivity, you know, pronghorns and other native species that were coming across. I got my assumptions busted pretty quickly on the trip about, you know, what was good and what was bad and what was fair. So, you know, I spent a chunk of time in that section of the river, and then it drops pretty quickly into kind of the Pinedale Anticline is one of the biggest oil and gas fields in the country. It's also a stronghold for sage grouse. So there's some really interesting things about native species and energy use up there. So you kind of go through that chunk of land, you come back into ranch land. Eventually you kind of go through some big city, probably isn't the right word because it's Wyoming, but you go into some of the bigger cities in Wyoming. So you kind of get this like taste of municipal use and how people are kind of using water in the ground. There's two big reservoirs on the river. There's Fontanelle and Flaming Gorge. And so looking at that stuff, I kind of got into some questions about what dams do to rivers and why water storage is important for how things happen downstream and also complicated in a lot of ways, and also how the kind of infrastructure of the middle of last century is still controlling how we do things now. And then you get into some of our kind of like most valued, highly valued, most preserved, you know, national park landscapes. So over the course of the river, you're kind of hitting
like every aspect.
Yeah. Kind of like all these pieces of like how we think about water and how water impacts places around us and the systems that, you know, food is a big system, you know, energy is a big system. Like it kind of is tied into these ways that we operate in the world.
Yeah. Well, and it's like when we zoom out, we sort of see those as like sectors, not people. Right. We see the energy sector, or we see the agricultural sector, or we see like urban development or rural development. But it seems so important to tell the story of the livelihoods attached to it, the history, the culture. And I think you bring up a great point that when we're comparing water use to other places, or when we're asking questions about how efficient something is, it looks really different from the outside than from the inside. And something like how many acres it takes to support a cow is maybe not a great way to think about it if there is a long-standing culture of certain agricultural practices, and if there isn't an easy path to livelihood for those communities in those places, right?
Or it's not immediately accessible to switch, like you were just saying, in terms of, you know, crop differentiation and diversity and things. That sounds like it makes sense in the lower, you know, river basin states, but less so in places where things are not going to grow. Or there's not.
And I think it's like, it's so one of the like big lessons for me on this trip, and I'm thinking about it, like I think I kind of came in with these pretty black and white ideas of what might be good or bad or like smart, and my kind of one of my biggest takeaways is like nobody's a jerk.
Swear away.
We're way worse than that, so you're good.
Nobody's a bad guy. Energy sector, there's some
jerks,
highly questionable financial environmental practices going on there, but outside of that I would say
a bunch of assholes.
Those guys are not nice. But for the most part, like everybody was like trying to do the best they could within the framework that they were operating. You know, like I talked to the guy who operates the Fontanelle Reservoir Dam, and that dam was sort of like a pork barrel project back in the day. It was supposed to be for ag, like things couldn't grow. It's sort of this like, now it's just sort of like a stopgap to get water, save water, and like met it out downstream when they need it. And this guy operating the reservoir was like, hey, what I do is like, I make sure that people downstream have water so that they can like, in August when the, you know, the snow's all melted, they can have showers.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, that seems important. Yeah.
So that's super comforting to me in one sense, that like the disagreements aren't as big as we think they are, but also that makes it in some ways harder to like, yeah. it makes it harder to see like, well, okay, then what's the solution when we have these like big allocation problems and scarcity problems, if everyone really is acting in good faith and just disagrees? Like, in some ways, that's like a harder problem to overcome, right?
Totally,
because there's nobody at fault, really. It's like
maybe
a vicious
problem.
Maybe it
is a little Pollyanna to be like, everybody's good, but there's not sort of like, if this was easy, people would have figured it out.
The idea is that it's the operative value is not always just self-interest. Like, it sounds like people do understand that they're playing roles, and those roles are, in connection with their relationships to others. But I had actually a question about that. So you're already talking about how it wasn't black and white, and there's a lot more contestation in how to understand these sets of relationships. When you were having some of these conversations, we've just been talking about, you know, water use in particular and water scarcity. Did you see any kind of similar, at least valuation of the climate change component of that story, or were you largely not necessarily talking about things with people in the context of climate exacerbating these things? Because we know the scarcity issue in and of itself is fraught, but then adding the climate element.
Yeah. And I think it's important to kind of like note too, that I did this trip in 2016, Obama was president. Like there's like things were different. I mean, they were different, but they were different. But I think even in that, political context was different, and that trickles into like NOAA forecasting, how the Bureau of Reclamation, like that big picture context has impact that trickles down. But nobody, even then, nobody I talked to was in, you know, had any kind of climate denial. And we're, you know, in the, even the ranchers in Wyoming, like those guys know every day what they know, whether historic water total. Yeah. They more than anyone kind of like have context on that. But I think that in, and maybe John talked about this, there's a really good paper that came out right around the time that I was working on this. That's, Brad Udall and Jonathan Overpeck. Those guys had a paper that came out in 2017 that showed how much climate change was evaporating water. It was basically when we've been in a drought in the Colorado River Basin for basically the past, since the turn of the century.
Right.
And that when things are hot and dry, everything needs more water. You know, like plants need more water. We need more water. Our energy systems need more water. And more water evaporates off of these big reservoirs, the storage canals. Actually, in that paper that came out recently that just accounted for, you know, how much ag water, I think it's like 10 or 11% of the total water is lost to evaporation.
Yeah.
So like when I was working on this paper, we were just kind of, people were quantifying more than they ever had before how much climate change is actually decimating and changing the river. Which is this crucial piece of understanding scarcity, understanding how much we actually have in our operating budget, kind of understanding how we can function. And I think that's sort of one of the hardest framework questions in all of this, or like kind of like hard things to wrap our brains around and then like align thinking with practice, is that when they wrote the Colorado River Compact, which is like the big legal framework for how we distribute water along the Colorado River Basin, which is like a big chunk of the West, they basically did the math wrong, and they like, you know, allocated more water than ever actually existed. And then we've had less because of climate change, because of that, you know, evaporating factors, because of how we're using it.
Well, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but that was in the 20s, and it was also coming on the heels of a historically wet decade. Like it,
yeah,
was,
exactly.
There was just more, one, they over allocated, and two, even had they allocated correctly, they didn't get a good sense for what the historic levels of the river were.
Yeah. And they kind of, there's been some kind of like thought recently that like they knew that. Mm. And you know, there was also this like, in that time and kind of in the end of the 19th century, there was this idea that like rain would follow the plow, and like,
yeah,
if you, you know, like,
well, just to explain to listeners what that means, yeah, right, really quickly, it's this like, right, this theory about how farming and agricultural and land use would actually impact atmospheric conditions. Is that fair?
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
And that, wait, like, you're saying that people can affect the climate?
Yeah, only in good ways, though.
Yeah. This was, this,
only when it's
Alex,
helpful.
This was when, you know, the more you use the land, the more you get what you need.
The more God provides.
Yeah. Well, so we got like half of that, right? We just, it just, the direction of change, right? Like the delta, we just got the sign on it wrong.
Yeah. There's flaps. Yeah. I totally lost my train.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, they're gone.
You were talking about in the 20s, how now there's some
how they
thought that
so
it was maybe
like this
purposeful that they miscalculated.
Yeah.
They,
but
known,
like, regardless of what the intention was, the way we have it set up, the math doesn't line up, and then we're losing more because of climate change. And then there's also this, the way it's broken up is by, they divided the Colorado River Basin into two basins, an upper and a lower basin. Every state gets, the lower basin gets a exact amount. The upper basin gets a percentage of how much comes down. It breaks into 7.5 million acre feet a basin. But because of that, and because that's a legal standard, then these states are highly protective of those numbers, even though they're sort of imaginary numbers.
Yeah.
So it kind of sets up this, I think that's sort of like the biggest scarcity framework, is that then people are pretty elbows out to be like, no, this is our amount.
That's one of the, I think that's one of the big challenge with like rights-based approaches to these sorts of resource problems in general, is once someone has that kind of claim, ownership creates sort of defensiveness over it.
Right. Totally, like once, yeah. once you have acre feet, then you're elbowing out everybody else from getting in on your acre feet.
Yeah.
Even if like there's not enough
your life on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. And then, you know, the way the doctrine of prior appropriations, which is how we allocate the water, basically means that the person who has the oldest right gets all their water before the next person gets theirs. So the frame, the way it's set up is sort of like anti-flexibility, anti-collaboration.
Yeah.
It's kind of set up in a way to have people be
territorial. So just to be, just to like illustrate that. So if we're both ranchers, but I set up shop 1 year before you and there's barely enough water for me to meet my needs, you don't get anything.
Yeah. Even if you're downstream of me, I have to let all your water go through.
Yeah.
And get it. And you get it before I get mine. And that goes back. It's like a gold mining era law. So basically like they didn't want to have a miner come in, like say you set up shop before me and then I came in a year later and set up shop like upstream of you. They didn't want you. It was like, so you would still get your claim first.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like so many of these laws and systems put in place, we don't realize how ingrained they become when we're working them out. And then 100 years later, we end up in these sorts of pickles. That seems like a big part of the problem.
So, you know, we were speaking a little bit with John about how some of these kinds of future recommendations seem to be setting up more cooperative schemes that help to work, even though the framework originally seems relatively rigid. I'm really curious, since you were really on the ground engaging with various communities, did people see themselves sort of like oppositionally by sector? Did people seem to understand themselves as like members of a community based on where they were territorially located? Was it like a state identity? So Wyoming's importance compared to, I don't know, any of the lower, you know, basin states? Did people kind of, in what way were people seeming self-determining in the way that they were identifying themselves as communities?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think all that. I think there is that sort of state, and I think it's partially because of the, you know, way the compact breaks it up. But I think there really is that, you know, especially in Wyoming, as in the upper basin. I mean, everybody hates California,
right? Of course. As a Californian, I know that because anytime I've traveled these places,
the one thing every sector and every state agrees on,
because everyone's just jealous. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I think there is some truth to that, because California kind of set up a lot of, you know, California has the oldest water rights in a lot of these places and the most powerful, you know, the Imperial Valley of California has like a huge amount of power when it comes to water.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, I think maybe to give like an example, I ended up going to this, I was in Vernal, Utah for what ended up being like a couple weeks. And I think Alex, you asked a question about this earlier about the logistics of the trip. And basically I was like on the river for anywhere from like 2 to 10 days. And then I would, depending on where I could permits and like where I could get out and that kind of thing. And then I would kind of be on the ground reporting and talking to people. And just cause the way that some of the permits lined up, I had 2 weeks to hang out in Vernal, Utah, which is like on the edge of Dinosaur National Monument, which is totally beautiful, but is also on the edge of like some pretty big gas patches. It's like fairly boom and bust economy. And there was this, it had been a pretty wet year and they were releasing out of Fontanelle Dam, or out of Flaming Gorge rather. When they have, I gotta back this up a little bit. Basically one of the, in the like rubric for how they end up releasing water out of the dams, one of the variables is endangered fish, which are protected by the Endangered Species Act, which is federal law, which has a lot of power. And that year they'd had a lot of water and they were pumping a bunch of water out of the dam to try and mimic, spawning cycles for these endangered fish, cause they had the water and cause the fish had been struggling. And that made a lot of the ranchers downstream really angry because it was impacting, they were getting these flood, you know, like flooding cycles. It had impacted some crops for some of the, there's also a pretty big like recreational fly fishing economy there. And some of the fly fishing guides were pissed off because they had been, you know, the eddies were getting blown out, the fishing was hard. And so they had the Reclamation, Bureau of Reclamation held this meeting to kind of like explain what they were doing. And so they had, and I was like, I'll go, this will be interesting. And it's like in the back of the rec center or whatever. And I show up and it's like, all the fishing guides are sitting here like this, and all the ranchers are sitting here like this. And then the like scientists are like kind of in the corner, and like everyone's kind of like wearing the outfits
with their team
they would be wearing.
Yeah.
and they're pissed.
Yeah.
Like there's like, I'm kind of sitting behind like a ranching family, and I can just like hear them, you know, like kind of talking under their breath. And like the woman who runs the dam kind of gets up and talks, and they have the fish biologist program talk. And then like people come up with questions, and they're kind of, you know, saying like, hey, I lost, you know, $100,000 on this because this happened. This is why this is hard. Mm-hmm. But being in that, and like at the beginning of that meeting, I was like, somebody's going to get punched today. Like, this is like aggressive. Like, this is like for a public meeting, this is tense. And that didn't totally diffuse, but over the course of that conversation, like where people could kind of talk to each other, I think there was a like that kind of understanding of like, oh, you're not just like doing this for no reason or trying to screw, like, mm-hmm. I understand that you're trying to do good, mm-hmm. and like I'm trying to do good. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is that factional, and I think this is, I mean, this is sort of like a countrywide
microcosm of a larger dynamic. Yeah.
That like, it's really easy to make assumptions about people. And like, if you can get people face to face kind of being like, oh, I understand this is hard, you can kind of break down some of those lines, but that's like impossible to do. Even in, you know, 40 million people in the Colorado Basin.
Right. Do you know in this particular example, or maybe in other examples, were community members or people from these various different, you know, interest groups or activities, did they have any kind of consultation process, or did you encounter cases where people had any kind of decision making or any kind of identifying maybe co-benefits where people could be compensated by anything? Or is that not yet really a dynamic? I mean, I know it's burgeoning in the renewable energy space and no one is doing this well, but I'm just curious if you saw any of those dynamics.
Yeah, I think kind of like burgeoning, nobody's doing it well is, because this is tricky stuff. And I think there have been pilot programs where people who work in ag are compensated for not, you know, irrigating. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out program, or like in a wet year. Because part of the problem with the prior appropriations is that if you don't use your water, you lose your right.
Yeah.
So people are defensive. And so there's some, excuse me, I think that's like one of the places where flexibility is starting to show up a little bit, where there could be those programs where like, okay, this year when you're okay, you can let it go. You're not going to lose your right. You're not going to forfeit anything, but you can kind of like give in to the pool a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of these places, it's like, yeah, I mean like federal procedures for comment periods are never great or accessible. You know, like there are these kind of like structural, it's hard to get everyone in the room to talk about it. It's hard to know who's affected.
Yeah.
But I think there's sort of like work to try and do that. But off the top of my head, I can't think of an instance where I think it's like really super smooth.
Good
and
model.
Happy. Yeah. But like, yeah.
Well, so if, I mean, in an ideal world, if we sort of fully develop these better systems of cooperation, do you think that there is enough water for everybody? Like if we get the policy right, if we get the cooperation right, if our institutions sort of prove to be adaptable, is there enough water?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think, and this is maybe in like Pollyanna again, but I think that it takes, yeah, I think in like an ideal, dreamy, snap your fingers, like we're good world, totally. But I think that takes a reframing of food systems. That takes a reframing of energy systems.
Yeah.
You know, like that, and that stuff is so, I mean, food's such an interesting one. Like we said, you know, like a big chunk of the water is going to alfalfa for cows, for, you know, like if we all snapped our fingers and stopped eating beef. You know, I stopped eating beef when I did the reporting for this because I was like, oh, this feels like I can see the cause and effect.
Well, what's so interesting about all of that is it like, yeah, it makes us rethink those industries, but also it means that like we can rethink some of these resource issues as not issues of true scarcity, but they really are socially created. They're made by us, which means that we can solve them.
Yeah. And there will be losses. I think that's the hard, like if we said, snap our fingers, we're not eating beef anymore, those people whose families depend on that, you know, what's their job? Where are they living? What's the, you know, like there are some, the trickle down of that kind of change is hard to think about and deal with. Like it's not easy.
Yeah. It's, we brought this up a little bit in our conversation with John, but like the, you know, the framework, I think I mentioned this, but the framework with the just transition at least offers, it's harder, you know, done than it is to be said, but it seems like it offers at least a model, right? That like the idea is if we are making these shifts or if we are impacting the intersection points of some of these different industries, leaving communities behind, right? Or leaving communities worse off is something that should be at the forefront. And it's just interesting because we constantly, I mean, I don't know, I'm curious, this was 10 years ago, you know, or almost 10 years ago when you were doing this. But I guess whenever we hear just transitions, it's constantly just referred to in the context of the energy sector and moving towards renewables. And increasingly, you know, I see it in issues of soil health and you know, talking to farmers out here and the soil microbiome and things like that, like actually talking to people about regenerative practices or switching these kinds of uses on an individual and then also in a community and then sector scale. It seems like we should be bringing the just transitions frame into all of this, but I'm not sure how prevalent that is in the water case or if.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, how does that, where
what would
those,
that look like?
Yeah. Is it coming from, where did the conversation start? Do they start in Pinedale, Wyoming? Do they, like, how do you kind of figure out what makes sense for any given community? Yeah. This is like.
One of the really big challenges there is this like cultural element that's really easy to brush aside from the outside. Right. But the ranching cowboy culture in the West is this, you know, 150-year-old identity that people have. And even the way in which livelihoods tied up with energy systems, it doesn't seem like the identity is as prevalent. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
Right? I mean, it's tough. I live in like the West Virginia of the UK, basically, like post-industrial former coal country. Yeah. And, you know, this is the place where, you know, Margaret Thatcher came and destroyed the mining unions and things. And there's still like major identity elements to what it is to be tied to those industries, even though the industry has been defunct for like 30 years. So depending on which generation I'm talking to, of course, you have that lost. Now, that's not the US, but I do wonder, Alex, like how much identity components are important, but also that we tend to like affix that those things are not flexible in some way. So
sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I think it's like, I mean, that I think a lot about that kind of like mythological American West.
Yeah.
I mean, like you think about how many people are watching Yellowstone right now.
Yeah.
Like that is the sort
exactly.
of like
yeah.
cultural
yeah.
iconography. But in a lot of these places, like these families that have been working the land for a long time, like their kids don't necessarily
not interested
work
yeah.
there.
Near the headwaters of the Green River, in Lander, Wyoming, my wife's grandparents were bison ranchers. And I got a sense from them in visiting the ranch many times that they were very proud of their buffalo as sort of like, what's the iconography that's even more American than the cowboy in the West? It's like bison in the West.
Yeah.
They use something like an order of magnitude less water than cows. Like there are, and I'm not saying like, great, every cowboy just become a, you know, a bison rancher. But that there are like alternative narratives and practices that maybe in aggregate can make a difference if supported, that are sort of less major leaps that aren't, you know, great rancher close up shop. I don't know. I mean,
it seems like it requires talking to people. Like Heather, you were mentioning, you know, getting people in a room to understand where everyone else was coming from seems to be important. But I would also imagine the flip side of that is also being heard and, you know,
totally.
Right. Being able to participate in these conversations instead of these transitionings happening to people.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, not really a question there, but just, yeah, I'm just wondering to what extent a major obstacle is we don't have very good infrastructural conditions set up that like offer the opportunity to genuinely be able to participate in decision making in a fully informed way, right? And also to be heard.
Yeah, I mean, this again feels like the national conversation.
Exactly. 100%.
People feel disenfranchised. They feel scared that like things are going to be taken away from them and things are going to be worse. And that, and you know, water is such an interesting piece of that because like it's so necessary.
Yeah. Elemental.
And, like, water, I think, means so many, you know, it's like water and life is life is kind of like a catchphrase, but it's totally true.
Yeah.
So I think there is this like real kind of like lizard brain fear of that scarcity.
Oh yeah.
People.
I mean, the notion of like water wars, right? Or the like, you know, apocalyptic ways that I think sometimes climate gets articulated about, you know, in people's imaginary, like always focuses around, of course, essential elements, and water's the one. So it feels really accessible in people's imaginary as like then the thing to have to hoard or protect and break down. So
yeah,
but you saying like yes, there's an opportunity to actually have enough is at least hopeful.
Yeah. I think it is like we have to, and you know, like whatever, golf courses get crapped on a lot, but like that kind of like we need to really, I think there's like some structural changes in how we operate that need to happen, or they're going to happen for us. And that's a really hard,
right?
In America, where we're all, you know, like independent cowboys, that's a really hard.
Yeah, I was reading one of your pieces, and you had made a comment that there, like you've noted that the Colorado River has changed significantly, is changing. There's a tremendous amount of like human hands, right, in that kind of management and change. But given the amount of time that you spent on the water itself, were there anything that you noticed about that experience or about just being on the river that still felt wild to you? Or did it, do you have a certain kind of conception of what wild was being in that kind of space for that long?
Oh, I love that question. Because I think that idea is like such a construction of our own mind. I'm working on a book right now that's about kind of women in the outdoors, and I feel like that plays in a lot in that question. And I kind of like wrestled with that a lot actually when I was on the river, because I would be, you know, I actually have this like very concrete memory of being in camping one night in Browns Park, which is below, it's kind of between Flaming Gorge Reservoir and there's a section that gets pretty heavily fished below that, and the Gates of Lodore, which is a section that's like one of the most primo, you know, whitewater river trips in the country, I think. And I was out there by myself. There was no one around. I was kind of in these like, you know, beautiful cliffy zones. And I was like, this just feels like so wild. But I could like, I knew there was a dam right upstream of me. Right. I knew that like the water was kind of clear because of the dam. I knew that like in the distance, I could kind of see hay fields that were like definitely not as sure. But like in my mind's eye, I was like, this is nature.
Yeah.
So I think it's like we're always sort of playing those tricks on ourselves.
Is it a trick, or is that just saying that like I feel like that really is wild. And like wild is just the experience that you're having. It's not about something out there. Like it's not a thing in nature. It's a way you relate to it. At least that's how I think about it.
Yeah. Or like our baseline is moving.
I mean, I have a discernible memory of surfing in Hollister Ranch, which is part of like, there's development still, but it's some protected coastline. So it's as, I don't know, quote unquote, natural of the California coast, right? It doesn't have $1 million homes right on the bluffs. And I remember surfing near Coho and like really fun south swell and just turning around and looking back at the California coast with like the scrub, right? And all the native wildflowers and no sign of human development, and you're out in the water and there's no infrastructure around. And I was like, oh, I'm back in time, right? Or this is California in its, which is of course like a myth, right? It's a mythology. It's also of course like erasure, right? in terms of the fact that people have been, you know, occupying these spaces, you know, well before settlers came through. But, and I think that experience, and then I did do some canoeing down the Colorado River for a week, like back in middle school, where we camped along the banks. And it was similar, like you go through parts of it where I don't know, you can feel transported in some ways, despite the knowledge of what you've just passed through, or that you're moving back into an industrial or an urban landscape with it.
And I do think it's like, I mean, maybe this is also like privileged colonial people who like stare at screens too much, but I do think there's like something really important about having, being able to get that, having, you know, like that kind of, or for me, at least I feel like that, where that like touch point does feels like so crucial to being myself and being a human.
All right, Simo, let's climb back out of the fishbowl.
Sorry. I imagine, like, you know how we all started the primordial swamp and then, you know, some little creatures just kind of like belly flopped onto land? That feels a little bit what you're inviting me to do.
Yeah, right, is
now.
That what happened?
That is exactly what I learned.
Yeah.
Thank you, public.
That's us.
Yeah.
We're going to climb back out of the primordial goo.
Yep.
And now we can maybe reflect back on what we've learned about scarcity. One thing that I think is super interesting is something you brought up before we talked to Heather that I want to reflect back on.
Sure.
So this idea that scarcity is not just a problem of resources, but also a narrative problem. It's a problem of how we talk about and understand scarcity. And when we're presented with an uncertain future that we're told is going to involve problems of scarcity, that has huge impacts on how people manage their lives today, even if there is enough, or even if there might be enough. It creates incredible uncertainty for people now. And there's incredible pushbacks in those narratives. Now, that's not to say we have enough water and we're going to have enough water, but that the way we talk about it is also changing how people are living in the world.
Yep.
With this challenge ahead of us.
And the framings, right, and the utilization of that can also be used in good faith and bad faith to galvanize people towards some set of, let's say, policy choices over others. But then there's also the sense in which maybe we don't take seriously oftentimes people's real immediate short-term concerns, right? So some of these issues of uncertainty when it comes to scarcity and the narratives that are dominant there, people are going to come down to, well, what about my livelihood now? What about looking back, like some of these farmers that have been inheriting the practices that they've been doing for a number of years?
Yeah.
Or what about, you know, communities that have been living along the river with particular sets of relationships? It starts to at least create or at least something that we can explore about creating tensions between how we bias those kinds of different preferences or concerns around livelihood and that kind of close proximity versus down the line.
There's a real way in which there are some folks who may look at this as a challenge of scarcity of resource tomorrow versus scarcity of money today.
Yeah,
right?
Another
type of resource, another type of trade-off. And maybe one way to move past this is to shift our narratives from scarcity to narratives of opportunity.
Right. The context of scarcity that there is actually space. I mean, I think what you're suggesting, right, is also a way to reframe how this was previously. We talked about, you know, climate exacerbating these common pool resource problems and just assuming certain kinds of human behavior was going to actuate in certain ways. And we learned that, you know, Ostrom suggests that actually maybe collaboration is actually at hand with these sorts of things. I think you seem to be offering a similar mind shift.
Absolutely. I think, for the Ostrom approach to work, we need to find ways to shrink our community. And it doesn't have to be literally shrinking our community. We have to find ways to communicate values across a big community, right? And if we can do that, we can talk in terms of opportunities, in terms of ways of saving water, in terms of ways of storing water, in terms of sharing water. We can find novel management policies that are opportunities for livelihoods in the future. And then we can also find opportunities in examples like Las Vegas that John brought up, examples from ranching communities that are finding efficiency and practices that can serve water at a larger scale.
New markets that can arise yeah, in the context of
these
things.
There's policy opportunities, there's market opportunities, there's personal opportunities, there's community opportunities. There are all these opportunities. And that's one way of creating a narrative that can help us move forward without some of those pitfalls.
And one last thing, you know, to think that goes within the context of this narrative is to remember that the context within which people are making decisions or determining what sort of norms of values should structure their deliberation on things, you know, scarcity might be playing in this context, but that may not necessarily be, you know, have a normative judgment, whether that's good or bad, but just to remember that if we are then evaluating the way that people are making certain kinds of decisions within those kinds of conditions, we might need to update our priors about what that kind of context is enabling them as seeing, having, you know, access to particular ways of reasoning and planning and things like that. So that was convoluted. I don't know how to say that in a way. Basically, that agents reasoning, you know, they may be reasoning rashly when they use a certain kinds of set of norms, know, in context of scarcity that they may not, you know, they may not be in other contexts. And we also have to update our thinking about that and what enabling pathways we have for people.
People's norms and values and people's context shapes how we coordinate and collaborate and how we see a world unfolding where we might seek to leave enough and as good of a resource for others.
Coming back to that proviso.
Should we leave it there?
Your favorite.
I told you already, I'm a big proviso guy.
Yeah, it's true. Thanks so much for listening to A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by me, Simona Capizani, and Alex Lee. Our show is produced and edited by Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're subscribed on any or all of your podcast platforms of choice. If you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating. Tell a friend. It really helps us out. Thanks again. See you next time.